Could the ongoing UN-sponsored climate talks have an agenda other than meaningfully addressing climate change? Why do activists and climate scientists consistently ignore evidence pointing to runaway climate change leading to the extinction of our species? How serious is the current climate dilemma? How can climate chaos be meaningfully addressed at the individual and community level? And how does the elevation of Donald Trump to the office of U.S. president change the calculus where climate action is concerned? This week on the Global Research News Hour, as the COP22 summit in Marrakesh, Morocco, draws to a close, three longtime observers of climate science and climate activism and former guests of this program return to share their analyses of the current state of affairs. We'll hear from London, Ontario-based investigative journalist Corey Morningstar, Emeritus Professor of Natural Resources Ecology and Evolutionary Biology Guy McPherson, and we'll hear from Dar Jamail, author of the regular climate dispatches at truthout.org. On this week's program, climate chaos worse than the COP22 is letting on. Conversations with Guy McPherson, Corey Morningstar, and Dar Jamail. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 18th, 2016. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Aside from the TPP and the TTIP that Pence is for and Trump's against, the VP favors the warmongering status quo, strongly opposing both Putin and Assad, and calling for a U.S. no-fly zone over Syria that amounts to war against Russia. In all likelihood, the Republican establishment made a deal with Trump that in order for him to become president, he must accept Pence as his running mate. Having a globalist as the next man in charge should Trump suddenly go down doesn't bode well if Trump actually means what he says and says what he means when he promises to, quote-unquote, drain the swamp. If he actually follows through on making efforts to fulfill his anti-globalist campaign promises that helped get him elected, he risks being murdered, just like JFK. If he turns out to be just another skilled con man, bought and sold already, he is playing out his scripted role as yet another Trojan horse puppet used by the planet's psychopathic rulers. That comes from the article, President Trump, the anti-globalist USA champion or just another con man riding a Trojan horse, by Joachim Hakopian, posted November 16th. 2 months ago, Hillary Clinton unwisely made the now infamous statement saying that half of Donald Trump's supporters were what she libelously characterized as a, quote, basket of deplorables, unquote. In the speech, Clinton went on to explain the phrase by saying that many of Trump's supporters were, quote, racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, and Islamophobic, unquote. Hillary could have legitimately elaborated by adding to her list of anti-democracy hate groups some of the following groups of ardent Trump supporters: sociopathic groups like the Ku Klux Klan, far-right-wing activists like David Duke, assorted neo-fascist groups, white supremacy groups, pro-Trump Make America White Again, and the hundreds of well-armed paramilitary vigilantes across America, as listed in the Southern Poverty Law Center's archives at www.splcenter.org/issues/hate-and-extremism. Perhaps a more quote-unquote progressive Hillary Clinton could have added some of the following white-collar Wall Street and War Street parasitic predatory capitalist and investor groups who thrive by feeding at the corporate welfare trough, who increase wasteful military spending, expand the American empire, privatize Social Security, and keep the for-profit prison system privatized and highly profitable for investors. There are many anti-democratic American groups that have emerged since the Trump campaign's success from both Washington insider swamps and non-Washington outsider swamps who are feeling their oats and are becoming energized Trump sycophants because of his vote-getting promises, most of which will not be kept. That comes from the article, Donald Trump Draining the Swamp, the Alt-Right Backlash, Infesting the White House with Right-Wing Extremists, Pro-Corporate Lobbyists, and Assorted Deplorable Washington Insiders, by Dr. Gary G. Coles, posted November 16th. The issue of Hispanic immigrants, most notably Mexicans, riles various U.S. citizens concerned that a reconquista, pecking away at U.S. sovereignty, is in the making. Trump's promised wall along the Mexican border is not so much a practical response as a viscerally padded one, rooted in the symbol of control long lost. Since a Trump administration is supposedly going to be all about business, the near impossibility of achieving the totality of such an ignoble dream will come to the fore. The balance sheet of contributions by immigrants, whatever their status, has always outweighed by some good margin what negative aspects the vast pool offers the United States. Furthermore, the undocumented pool provides a class that enables prices, however justly this may seem, to be kept down. That comes from the article, Trump's Card on Illegal Immigrants, From Obstacles to Impossibility, by Dr. Binoy Kempmark, posted November 16th. Multiple media reports that former New York City Republican Mayor Rudolph Giuliani is President-elect Donald Trump's top choice for Secretary of State have provided further indication of the extreme right-wing and militarily bellicose character of the incoming U.S. administration. A senior Trump campaign official told the Associated Press Tuesday that Giuliani was the favorite for the post, while indicating that the equally right-wing and militaristic former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations under the administration of George W. Bush, John Bolton, was also in the running. The fact that these two, both adamant supporters of every U.S. war over the past quarter century, are the front runners for the top foreign policy position in the incoming Republican administration gives the lie to Trump's pretensions on the campaign trail that he was somehow opposed to recent U.S. military interventions and, quote-unquote, nation-building. Trump's phony claims that he had been against the Iraq War were meant to appeal to popular hostility to the endless U.S. military interventions with which his Democratic opponent Hillary Clinton was so clearly identified. At the same time, however, he repeatedly advocated a major increase in U.S. military spending and a modernization of Washington's nuclear arsenal. That comes from the article, Trump Transition Points to Escalation of U.S. Militarism, by Bill Van Auken, posted November 16th, originally appearing at World Socialist website. Polls showed that Bernie Sanders might well have beaten Trump. Not only did Sanders score much higher in likability than Clinton, but many moderate voters actually preferred Sanders. Remember, Sanders, like Trump, created a tremendous amount of excitement with massive turnout at his rallies. Clinton didn't. Clinton lost because Democrats stayed home, because they weren't excited about her. That comes from the article, Five Stunning Facts About the 2016 Election, by Washington's blog, posted November 16th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. This is Michael Welch from the Global Research News Hour, and we're recording a special interview here at CHRW, the University of Western Ontario. I'm joined in studio by Corey Morningstar, an independent journalist who's authored a number of articles on the subject of the nonprofit industrial complex and some of the ways in which climate activism has been skewed by the involvement of these foundational supports from foundations. She writes at theartofannihilation.com, And she also contributes to the website wrongkindofgreen.org. And joining us by phone from Belize, where he is now centered, headquartered, is none other than Guy McPherson, who's a holds a professor of emeritus of natural resources and ecology and evolution and evolutionary biology from the University of Arizona. He has written extensively on the topic of near-term human extinction. We've had him many times on the show. And of course, he's authors the Nature Bat's Last blog at guymcpherson.com and is also regularly broadcasts on the Progressive Radio Network, the Nature Bat's Last radio program. And so, Corey Morningstar, Guy McPherson, welcome back to the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Thank you, Michael, very much. It's always a pleasure to be with you, and it's quite an honor to be on the air with Corey as well.
Okay, so this week, of course, the topic that's in everybody's minds and is completely blanketing the media, and that's the climate talks in Morocco right now. Well, I'm just kidding. I think there's certain other topics that have kind of blanketed the media, but I think it is kind of important to bring up the issue of climate and the way it's being addressed by the COP summit. I don't know how carefully either of you have been monitoring what's been coming out of there, but as far as I could determine, the focus seems to be mostly on the issue of carbon pricing and also just how we proceed with an economy that is going to be advancing the cause of reducing emissions with the goal of staying under 2 degrees Celsius, that 2 degrees Celsius benchmark be above what that baseline from pre-industrial times, and as well they are aiming for a zero carbon economy by the year 2050, although I have not heard anything mentioned yet about methane and self-reinforcing feedback loops and basically most of the other things that we've heard about in discussions with the two of you. So I don't know if you'd maybe Guy, you'd like to talk about some of the things that this is basically where the Paris climate talks goes into the practical mode and applying strategies. Some quick thoughts about this current conference, Guy.
Yeah, I can pretty much guarantee there will be a zero emissions economy by 2050. Foremost, because I can't imagine there will be a human on the planet at that point, and even if there were, it's difficult for me to imagine instead of living on was hanging around that long. So I don't think that's going to be a problem. I think the major predicament that this version of COP will be able to address is that it's civilization itself that is the heat engine, as put out by Tim Garrett's work on thermodynamics at the University of Utah now, with a few publications to his credit pointing out that civilization itself is a heat engine. I don't see anybody at Marrakesh or anywhere else in the United States or in the civilized version of society indicating that we should stop, that we should stop heating by terminating civilization. So that's the elephant, that's one of the many elephants we don't see being addressed.
Corey Morningstar, you pointed out through your research that there was a decision way back, or a finding way back in 1990 that indicated that the 2 degrees Celsius benchmark is not a true scientific benchmark.
No, and Guy's well aware of that study as well. He has a copy of it. It has always been 1 degree, the maximum, that we should not exceed. And so the whole 2 degrees been a complete reframing. It's not science at all. It's just a mechanism to keep growing the economy and keep the system going for the few that it serves. So this whole thing about 2 degree is, it's outrageous to begin with. And, we were talking earlier about the fact at one point all the climate scientists involved at that time would have fully known that it was 1 degree. And then when it was basically economists, William Nordhaus in particular, suggested the 2 degrees so we could keep growing, because obviously we can't mitigate climate and grow the economy at the same time, plus keep the industrial civilization machine running. And so, you know, it's interesting that somehow everyone acquiesced to that. Let's, you know, basically let that die, the 1 degree, and we'll reframe it, the language all around 2 degrees, and everyone, you know, it's almost like self-censorship. Everyone at that time obviously fell into line with that whole reframing and language around 2 degrees. And so we're not even discussing, you know, the real science and the real boundaries, the planetary boundaries.
Guy, could you maybe explain your understanding of that? Because Corey's just pointed to the idea that it's not just activists who are, you know, in denial, as she put it, but scientists. I mean, shouldn't it be clear from the data, this 1 degree Celsius benchmark that she just related, that, you know, we're like, how do you account for that denial from hard-boiled scientists who are supposed to look at the data? I mean, I just, for example, I just want to add on one more point, is that I did try to set up a conversation with another individual who is a very highly esteemed climatologist back in Winnipeg, and I mean, apparently they tried to set up an interview, sort of a discussion with you the first time you came into Winnipeg in 2014, and he refused to engage you because he felt that your ideas was just too out there. So I don't know. What is your understanding of the resistance to confronting these difficult, you know, from scientists?
Right. Well, scientists are part of the set of living arrangements of civilization. In fact, they benefit greatly from the privilege afforded by civilization. There's a couple of things here. One, we pointed out the October 1990 report of the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases. That's the same United Nations that is sponsoring these talks, COP22 in Marrakesh, Morocco. And the whole organization seems to have forgotten what they penned as the upper level of the temperature above baseline that we hit safely 26 years ago. And so the whole conversation has been hijacked by William Nordhaus and other neoclassical economists, which is absurd. And another trick that the scientists play on themselves and on the rest of the and James Hansen is the most recent person I've seen do this, is they switch the baseline. The baseline is no longer 1780, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Sometimes the baseline is 1880, so we ignore the first 130 years of the Industrial Revolution. Sometimes the baseline is actually 1951 to 1980, so in that, you know, ignore the first 200 years of the Industrial Revolution. So we have this phenomenon with the shifting baseline, ignoring the scientific information from more than two decades ago, instead capitulating to economists. I have a PhD minor in neoclassical economics, and I think it's safe to say at this point that anybody who knows anything about economics recognizes that it's called the dismal science for a reason. I would call it the dismal non-science. It's a set of assumptions completely ungrounded that serve as the basis for absurd conclusions. In any event, the response of the quote civilized science is to shift the baseline, change the story, and a large part of that is to ensure that their paychecks keep coming. There's no way to remain supported, and I'm using that word carefully, to remain supported in your job as an academic scientist or a government scientist if you point out that we have your self-reinforcing feedback loops. People know that with respect to climate, the situation is no longer under human control. If it was ever under control. So if you can't remain rooted in your job, in your work, and you believe that your life and the lives of your family member depends upon your job, then it becomes pretty easy to ignore the evidence or to believe a different version of the evidence, a milder version of the evidence. And so then you start censoring, and you're being censored yourself. And so there are many examples now of climate scientists at major universities who have been censored and changed their lives in some manner or significant way as a result. I don't think there's any question about the evidence on that issue.
Because, I'm just remembering that line from that show, The Newsroom, in which they brought in this sort of climate realist to talk to the anchor, and saying that the issues around the threat from climate change are no more negotiable than the boiling point of water, or something to that effect. But what I hear you pointing out here is that, you know, scientists are still people who need to continue to be fed and have research that they need to do, and then there are these external indications that are affecting our research, and I no doubt that's got to be filtering its way through to these major conferences. And, you know, what's your take on this, Cora?
Sure.
Well, I think conformity is incredibly powerful, and I think it's very underestimated. I mean, the nonprofit industrial complex and the not just the mainstream media, but the liberal so-called quote-unquote progressive media are very important critical tentacles of state and empire. I think it's very, very difficult when they're in charge of creating, you know, this incredible framing and language. They create the framing, create the language, and they create the story. And it's very difficult when you have all your peers in a whole society going along with the stories that they produce and the language and the framing to take a different position. I mean, if that's done, like Guy said, you can quickly be, you know, pretty much eradicated and isolated. I mean, the nonprofit industrial complex is notorious for using isolation as a tool to, shut out dissent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like for individual activists and organizers, and we were talking about this briefly, there's been climate activism for a long time, but it seems that more and more these foundation-funded networks are coming to dominate the scene and assimilate the grassroots groups, and so there's a little bit of innocent enough, you know, people, you know, a lot of these on the ground activists are getting caught up in it, but, and they're certainly earnest and genuine, but they don't realize that they're being manipulated for other reasons.
They're very much reabsorbed back into the system that they're trying to oppose. If Guy doesn't mind, I just wanted to touch upon what happened in 2009 at COP15. Basically, what you have, like, I've found documents that I have published online, actually, from Greenpeace in 1990, where they reference the 1 degree limit. Jump forward to 2009, and all of a sudden you have Greenpeace, which has now formed an umbrella group, Tick, 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 which basically absorbed all the, you know, international NGOs in the world, and they came to Copenhagen, which was supposed to be, you know, the big, big win for climate, and they basically, through the echo chamber, they really, really secured and put out there that 2 degree target. You know, a target is something you're supposed to accelerate to, right? A target, like even the target is framing, right? We keep going until we reach our target. So anyway, you have Tick, 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 Greenpeace, which is the same group. They're all working with Havas, this huge, one of the biggest in the world advertising agency. And they create this, this platform, and they suck in, they get millions upon millions of signatures and endorsers, and you've got this huge storyline. Basically, you had the G7 Bolivian small island states at Copenhagen demanding that we do not exceed 1 degree. I mean, the very people on the front lines. And then you had Tick, 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 Greenpeace350.org, all the big NGOs under their Tick, Tick, Tick umbrella demanding double that. You know, and then the small island states, the G77, Bolivia, putting out radical emissions that were, you know, probably even as radical as they were not enough, and then completely marginalized and made invisible by the nonprofit industrial complex. And so the nonprofit industrial complex serves as a system in place financed by the foundations through their corporations and elites to keep the current power structures intact, and not only keep them intact, but expand them. And here we have all of our, you know, well-intentioned people, youth, active people getting sucked back into this. And so it's a massive problem, and no one talks about it because, quite frankly, everyone's on the payroll, you know?
Mm-hmm. Guy, there's the sacrosanct body known as the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is assessing all of the evidence and putting it together and putting forward their proposals. Now, I know that you've effectively been doing the same thing. You have your monster climate essay, which is just full of, I'm not sure exactly how many, but hundreds of peer-reviewed articles, including, and you managed to keep it up to date. So, how can I put this? I mean, are we talking about something more than the kind of sociological factors you mentioned earlier about people's livelihoods being on the line that is interfering with coming up with the more hard cold numbers that should be forwarded to the public through the IPCC about the state of the environment? Because I don't see much coming from them about methane, for example, or the self reinforcing feedback loops. It always seems to be something on the horizon. So are there structural factors there that are interfering with that?
Analysis. The IPCC ignores many of the self reinforcing. One of the reasons for that is the nature of the way they do business. And so included within that is the working groups, scientific working groups, are required to reach consensus on any documents they put out. And they begin with the referee journal literature. So if it's not in the referee journal literature when they start the process, these working groups, then it's not included. So, for example, Monte Tipis, the latest one to come out, the word methane twice in a single table in the entire document. And so, for starters, we're beginning with referee journal literature, which is conservative in and of itself and is characterized by censorship and the censorship along the way. And then the documents, which are conservative because there are scientists involved and particularly academic, and then they rely upon consensus. Then we go to the next step, and the documents, before they're released to the public, they go through the political process. By the time all this is said and done, the information that appears in the document released to the public, all that information is at least 5 years old, in many cases quite a bit old. So structurally, it's a process that ensures the most conservative possible outcome. What we're talking about here is a really, really dangerous situation, and the precautionary principle is completely in taking this most conservative possible approach. That's hugely problematic. Not just the scientists, it's the process itself of collating and distributing the information that presents tremendous problems, we'll say, along the way.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Maybe you could comment on some of the most recent
developments that you've seen that that maybe we should be responding to, that anything over the last 2 or 3 months worthy of note?
Yeah, well, basically I think the short story of that 30,000 plus word essay is told in an essay I posted August 1st of this year called The Politics and Science of Our Demise. And it actually connects the self-reinforcing feedback loops, adds them together, and includes also the absence of global dimming when civilization ceases to be sustained. And it comes up with a temperature within the next 10 years at or approaching the highest temperature the Earth has reached within the last 2 billion years, somewhere between 22 and 23 degrees Celsius, taking the most conservative imaginable approach. And of course, very few scientists are going to admit that in public because of the first word of that is politics and science of our demise. So I know that, for example, at least Ohio State University, University of Texas in Austin, the University of Arizona, and Cambridge University have all actively censored scientists. And in three of those cases, they were climate scientists. In the case of the University of Arizona, it was me, and I referred to myself as a conservation biologist, not a climate scientist. But Peter Wadhams is the most recent person, formerly head of the ocean physics program at Cambridge University. He's been squeezed out by Cambridge and has gone to an institution in Ireland instead. He was forced to retire. And I suspect that has something to do with his fairly radical statements that he's making. Here's a man who has 50 exhibitions to his credit on or beneath the Arctic sea ice. So this is what I consider a significant authority when it comes to methane being released from beneath the Arctic Ocean, and also the effects of Arctic ice on albedo and therefore heating the planet. And he's cast aside, I think, in large part, not because his research has been suffering or because his teaching is worse than it's ever been, but rather because the information that he's been putting out comes really close to matching reality. And in a set of living arrangements founded on lies and the promulgation of money, reality doesn't fit very well.
Yeah, and I just, sort of expanding on that idea, it seems as if we have there's a kind of a prime directive that directs everything that we do, and that is that all of us as human beings, we have this larger kind of a community, not unlike an ant in an ant colony that directs how we interact with things. So ultimately, even if we're talking, looking at, scientific information, there will be systems in place worked out, perhaps consciously, perhaps unconsciously, that will keep you from deviating from that ultimate, unquestionable axiom that civilization, that very thing that is a heat engine, must go on. So as long as you don't question that civilization, we can talk about quote-unquote solutions. Corey, you have any thoughts?
Well, exactly. I mean, I think it's important to understand that these climate talks, they're not at all to mitigate, let alone solve, which can't be solved because, as Guy says, it's a predicament, the climate crisis. They're all about growing the economy. And, as ants, as you refer to us, that's the thing. The economy is God, the civilization, those things cannot be questioned, by society. Those things are beyond reproach. The so-called solutions, which are only market-based solutions, they're all nuclear, carbon capture storage. I mean, we use these things which aren't renewable, which aren't clean anyway. I mean, solar turbines, all this, which we pretend are clean, which will only serve to perpetuate further war and imperialism. But we use these things as a veneer to create this illusion of this beautiful, clean world. But in the background, it's nuclear. It's financing. It's actually putting a price tag on nature, assigning value to nature through payments for ecosystem services. This is all going down in the back rooms. These are the deals, the policies that are being created. Nothing to do with slowing down growth. I mean, you can't, right? Slow down growth, the whole system collapses like a house of cards. So it's not even about solving anything. It's about how do we keep the economy growing. Right now, the global economy is almost at stall speed. You know, if it stalls, it collapses. So this is all about, you know, this is more of an emergency. How do we grow? And the climate is sort of like we will grow it and steal what's left in the treasury under the guise of solving climate. It's to make people feel good, to further, you know, they can feel good while they we're all involved basically in our own annihilation, you know, participating in our own annihilation. But you can feel good about it and be sure that there's solutions down the road, but there aren't.
Mm. Well, environmental activism and climate activism, it wasn't always about how to help the 1% continue business as usual, but you know, here's finding new profit making motives. I mean, which seems to be the baseline of these major NGOs with that foundation funding from the Rockefellers and then Soros and so on. So, I mean, could you possibly articulate what an alternative to that could be, what we have seen in the past that could perhaps be applied if we were to, because I think it's important we do have this conversation, but you know, it would have to take a different form from the kind of manipulative template that we have before us. So what could you see as a way that we could respond that would be meaningful?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, first of all, we need to withdraw our support from the NGOs, which basically would leave them powerless, and put it into true legitimate grassroots, you know, especially locally. Like, why not work locally where you are? And a simple thing, I think a really good starting point, we won't stop climate change, but we can certainly try to mitigate our impact. And we could all start working together, permaculture, growing food, creating local food systems. I think that's a doable thing and a good place to start. I mean, there's just so much to say about that, but even how the nonprofit industrial complex, the NGOs, how they are absorbing all the grassroots resistance, everything is being absorbed by these groups. And we're not, I mean, we somehow, well, it's not somehow, through social engineering, conditioning, through, you know, incredibly savvy and beautiful media campaigns, lots of money, trillions of dollars are, you know, laundered through the complex. We believe that we're fighting for solutions. We're fighting for what's already being designed by the elites that finance these NGOs in the back room. Like, we're fighting for what they want. That's what we're fighting for. They want a globe, you know, basically redesigned in new infrastructure to serve the people that already have it, because it's like a new market. There's just no place left to go. Right now we're looking at how do we create new markets. Well, one way is absolutely to create a whole global infrastructure, and another way to create a new market is to now assign a price to every single living thing on this planet. So, I mean, that's what we have to realize through these groups, who they're working for. They're not working for us. Hmm. They're working for their funders.
Yeah. Guy McPherson, I think you believe that even though I think it is important to have this conversation, and I think it is important to be active, but we need to reframe it so that it's not, we have to do this or else we're dead. I mean, it's going to happen anyway, but that doesn't mean we don't have the conversation. It doesn't mean that we don't continue to stop, you know, to try to block the growth of pipelines and growth that in and of itself is toxic to all living life on the planet. How could you conceive of a way of having that conversation, of being active, that's going to be more, sane?
Well, you know, a question like this frequently, mostly from activists who have spent much of their life as activists, and then they come across my message and they say, hey, we failed. And so you, Guy McPherson, are telling us to not do activism anymore. And that's not right. I'm inspired by a Buddhist perspective. I believe we should take right action and not be attached to the outcome. So I'm a huge fan of activism. I'm not much of an activist myself. I put together the science and relatively unconstrained by the culture in which we're all embedded, I try to put out the information about the unspeakable, about the feedback loops that nobody else is willing to talk about or write about. So there are a variety of things we can do that don't mean we have to, quote, give up, whatever that means, give up your activism, give up doing the right thing, whatever the right thing is, or even give up what feels best to us, as long as we recognize that sometimes that feel good comes from those organizations Corey pointed to. And in that case, it's strictly marketing. And so by capitulating to that version of culture, to conformity, to conform with the masses as a way of feeling better, what I'm trying to get people to do is dig a little deeper beneath the surface. And I think that's what Corey's work does so well, is it digs a little deeper beneath the surface and points out that clean energy is not clean. And when we live a certain way and we demand certain things, that comes at a cost. That nothing in life is free, as Barbara Kingsolver wrote in a book a long time ago. Living takes life, but it can be thoughtful. And I really like that second thought, that it can be thoughtful, because sure enough, every breath we take almost certainly reduces the lifespan of some other organism on the planet. Does that mean we should stop breathing? That's not what I'm suggesting at all. I suggest that we live with two outcomes in mind. What it is taking down with us, and with our own death in mind, so that we have a sense of urgency about how we live and what we do for the next minutes, the next days, the next hours, the next weeks of our lives.
Corey, I know, like, I could see that kind of like a Buddhist or existential sense that, you know, we may be all dead in 20 years time, but, you know, there, we could at least leave some kind of a legacy that there's more to humanity than being a bunch of selfish jerks that polluted their bed with plastic and nuclear radiation, that there was at least some effort to offer up an alternative. But at the same time, I don't have children and I don't have grandchildren, and you do. So I'm wondering what your own, having confronted these truths, how you proceed day to day.
I think the reason, I mean, a guy knows that people have, you know, I heard that going years back, people hating basically on Guy because of his message and how they misconstrued it as, you know, give up, you know, you can't do anything anyway. And I understood back then, and even more so now, that's not at all what he meant. I mean, I totally get him and I get what he's saying. And I mean, I think the part of the problem is society, this culture tells us we are so important. You know, it's, and you get it from religion, you get it from culture, you get it from media, you get it from everything. We are so human-centric. And I mean, if you can let that go, if you can understand or not, we've been here for a blink. We don't matter more than anything else, more than a leaf on the tree outside, more than that ant, you know, that's, you know, under the leaves on the ground. Like, we just have this idea of self-importance. And why can't we just be decent to each other? I mean, I plant trees. That's how I stay sane. I garden. I'm outside all the time. I appreciate life. I mean, there's a lot of great people on this planet that have had nothing to do with what we've created. But to me, I mean, we have to go to let anything else live at all. Humans have to go. I mean, we are... a death machine. You know, this society, this civilization is a death machine. And it won't stop. I mean, nothing's going to stop unless it collapses. And even then, I mean, the science behind global dimming. I mean, I just think we have to let go of our self-importance as humans. You know, we're wiping out everything, you know?
Yeah, we're sort of at the mercy of the bed that we've, the seeds that we've sowed.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you know, I'm just about, I think we're just about at the end of our time now, but I don't know if there's any parting thoughts that you might like to put forward. I mean, I was hoping this might be like a Trump-free zone, but I don't know if that's a significant development or if that enters into your mind any significant response, because that's certainly something. I mean, here's someone who's maybe not in line with what the foundation-funded NGOs are pushing for. So,
Guy, do you want me to say something to that?
Well, I view the entire world anymore through this lens of absurdity, inspired by Camus, and so and as an anarchist for a long time, I haven't voted for a long time. I see all this pushback about Trump, and I think, you know, the United States is characterized by worship for money, extreme racism, and extreme misogyny. And the United States elects a president who is incredibly wealthy, who's obsessed with money, who's an amazing misogynist and racist, and people are surprised. Really? It's exactly the film I would have expected from the election. It's a free electoral process, even. So, you know, I hardly even think about it. The governments, all that is beyond my ability to have any influence over. I try to remain present with people and with the world that I actually inhabit in this little small pocket of the planet, and not to get too worked up about those larger scale phenomena.
Yeah, I mean,
especially
we were yesterday, we're today. I mean, you know, Clinton, Trump, they're both disgusting. I mean, obviously, you know, it's just funny that people are so offended by everything Trump says, but look at what Obama and Clinton have actually done. I mean, they're all so offensive. And it's just bizarre to me to see now all of a sudden it's like the Democratic Party's been appointed some sort of sainthood, you know, because of Trump. They're all horrific. I mean, the system's horrific, right? And yeah, just we're a killing machine. So. Yeah, I agree with Guy. It's just a waste, really waste of... It's just entertainment, really, more or less.
Okay. Well, I've enjoyed having...
I think Frank Zappin...
Go ahead.
I think Frank Zappa nailed this one when he said, politics is the educational branch of the military industrial complex.
Well said. And... Well, I think we're going to have to bring the conversation to a close now, but I really enjoyed having the two of you on in this special episode of our show. Corey Morningstar, independent journalist, who's authored a series of very enlightening articles at her site, theartofannihilation.com. And of course, Guy McPherson, whose blog, Nature Bats Last, is available at... GuyMcPherson.com. Thank you both for coming on the show.
Thank you, Michael, for having Guy and I.
Thank
it was a pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure, Michael. And thank you, Corey.
Joining me now to discuss the current state of the climate crisis and the way the international community is or is not responding is Dar Jamail. He is an award-winning journalist and author. He gained notoriety over a decade ago with his unembedded coverage of the Iraq War. He contributes regular climate dispatches to truthout.org. He joins us now from Washington State, where he's headquartered. Dar Jamail, it's a pleasure to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
The Conference of the Party talks is coming to a close as we're having this conversation. The focus is on actionable policies for implementing the Paris Agreement, which is supposed to keep the global average temperature between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial baseline. You've been monitoring the climate indicators as you survey the Arctic, the oceans, the global north, the global south, small island states, and more. What would you say are the most significant developments that you've come across that you really think should be ringing alarm bells in Morocco and elsewhere? Could you maybe, I don't know, bullet point three or four of them?
Yeah, that's easy. You just mentioned that they're talking about trying to maintain global temperature increase to between 1.5 and 2 C. This year, we're almost already at 1.5 C. As we're speaking right now, the North Pole is 36 degrees F warmer than normal. It's supposed to obviously be well into winter up there, but it's literally 36 degrees warmer than normal, which is unbelievable, almost something you'd expect to see in some kind of a sci-fi movie. Already this year has been declared as the hottest one on record, and we still have 6 weeks to go. Last month was the second warmest October ever recorded in history, whereas before that, every single month of the previous 10 months was that warmest month, respectively, ever recorded on record. Just to circle back around, this year already declared it will be the hottest ever recorded, surpassing last year, which at that time was the hottest year ever recorded. So just a few bullet points to give folks an idea how far along we already are.
What's happening in our oceans? Because it seems to me that that's it's like 70% of our Earth. So is there anything there that you think is merits discussion that maybe is not getting mentioned?
Well, one thing that while it's gotten a lot of media, I think the importance of what it means has not gotten enough attention, and that is the tremendous bleaching event that happened along the Great Barrier Reef over the last year. More than one-fifth of that reef died off this year, and this is expected to be the new norm. So it'll be really surprising if within about 10 years from now, if there's really much left at all of the Great Barrier Reef. Leading coral scientists have stated now for a couple of years that because of warming and acidification that we're on track to not have any coral left anywhere in the oceans by the year 2050. This is a cataclysmic development for most ocean life, and other reports coming out about how oxygen levels in the ocean are decreasing while warmth continues to increase, causing these really dramatic shifts. And, you know, just to put that in perspective, the oceans are where we came from. So it's quite important that they not be undergoing the catastrophic shifts that they are. And unfortunately, when the oceans have gone, that has been the precursor of the majority of the mass extinction events prior to the one that we've just entered now, the sixth mass extinction event. So this is a very worrisome sign as well.
Now, in terms of action, there's been a lot of emphasis on transition to a renewable economy and to calling on carbon pricing as a part of some sort of a reorientation of our economic system. Do you support a more aggressive pursuit of those goals, or do you find them altogether diversionary?
Well, I think they're somewhat, at least the way they're reported on, their diversion areas, though, well, if we just make these switches and make these adjustments and impose a carbon tax and things like this, then we're going to be able to continue forward with business as usual as far as our lifestyles and consumption rates, and maybe not pressing as hard as we need to for the dramatic and immediate changes that need to be made. So while I think things like switching to renewables and getting off fossil fuels immediately is critically important and needs to be discussed, along with simultaneously dramatic lifestyle changes in the West, I think that they're often used as kind of a way to not really look at the situation with the urgency with which it demands.
Now, I'm wondering about a different response, not so much the mitigation aspect, but the adaptation aspect. You know, is there more of a role for the international community to play in promoting adapting to a changing climate, resilient solutions? What is your take on those sorts of actions and how they're progressing?
Well, there's really some of it is getting discussed, which is a positive thing, but I think as far as actually taking appropriate actions, there's certainly in the West, particularly in the United States, there's little to nothing going on. Most of the really effective actions that are happening are on a very small level, like community level, sometimes on a city level. But for example, Miami, all leading sea level rise experts say that, look, Miami's basically the next Atlantis. There needs to be plans well underway of how you're going to go about relocating the better part of the people living in that city. And that's just not happening. Instead, you've got a situation where, you know, the government of the state of Florida won't even allow the words climate change in their documentation, et cetera. So obviously a little bit of progress needs to be made as far as that kind of adaptation, as well as I think kind of tying into what I just mentioned, that, you know, all of us need to be actively taking a role in adapting our own lifestyles of not traveling much, if anymore, on jets, on figuring out where our food is coming from and our water, and making sure that's local and making sure that's reliable and resilient, and as well as community building, because this is the era that we're going into, both climatologically and politically here in the United States. And so any discussions that aren't on those lines, I think, basically are not really operating in reality.
Hmm. Well, I appreciate your pointing out concrete examples of actionable policies that could be taken at the community level. But like right now, we have President-elect Trump, and he's selected key figures in his administration. There's this Myron Ebell, who's going to be overseeing the transition of the EPA, and he's a major. He's not only heavily invested in the whole fossil fuel industry, but is an outright climate denier, as is Mr. Trump himself. And of course, I mean, so much of the structure of this incoming administration seems to be worse than what you saw previously, which is not to say that the previous administration were angels either. Can you continue with those sorts of community level initiatives while ignoring what the big boys are doing? How do we confront that, or is that?
I think we're morally obliged to confront it. I think we have to do both. That's my simple answer to your question. I think it's a very important question that you ask, and I think that, like, using myself as an example, I write my articles for Truth Outs, and I keep our readers abreast on what is happening with the climate, as well as I have a piece coming out next week really going into great detail about the individuals that you just mentioned, of Myron Bell and several of the others that he's looking at for Department of Energy or Department of Interior. That's my way of staying active in a very public way and nationally, while personally on a daily basis figuring out how can I continue to use less and less energy. You know, I'm going to get off this phone call and go do some work in a community garden that I'm a part of, as well as working on my own at my own home. So things like this, you know, building our own resiliency on a local level and building community while staying very active nationally, because certainly here in the United States, we have a fight on our hands, and everyone I know are really kind of circling the wagons and getting ready for an extremely rough time ahead. But because people understand, A, we need to be able to take care of ourselves, and B, we need to figure out how we're going to wage a very serious fight against what's about to come straight at us.
Dr. Jamail, your reporting on abrupt climate change disruption is a necessary climate reality check, and I want to thank you very much for making yourself available to our listeners. So thank you for joining us once again.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Dar Jamail. He is an award-winning journalist and author. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Our interview with Corey Morningstar and Guy McPherson was recorded at CHRW Radio at the University of Western Ontario. Many thanks to Richard Raycraft and the CHRW staff for their generous assistance and support. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.